I'll be there, just let me know. Let me know when there is a
so, because you have our last problem.
I'm missing you that you are.
Not even but the booking, the salad, the barbs, the fascists, after the size of the
other people.
Think about during the week.
That's a good idea to write down the questions.
Gavin, you always see people make that pen before they start writing.
Yeah, why do they do that?
Because it gets the ink, like.
Exactly.
I tried it last night. I did it last night, and I was like, you have to worry about it.
It's not fair. It's the same thing, right? You can look at it as if they're both holding on to it.
Yeah, we don't
really maybe we should play, but
why not?
If I wish,
what
about Talus? How did Talus?
You're not consuming the ink. There's no ink on the ball. You're not tasting the ink. You're lubricating the ball.
It goes on your tongue.
No, it's a ballpoint pen. You don't do that with a ballpoint pen. You do it on a pen that the ball has to be like moving so that the ink
flows. No, the thing is, they're holding through you. So really,
you get ink at the end of your tongue.
You look in a mirror after you did it to see if you had ink.
The heroes have a debatable holding through you onto this last album. So why can't
even if there is ink dry, he said a few weeks ago about there not being a problem with dry things when we're asking about
exactly. So we're saying what this principle does not apply.
Building cuts
cannot be true. There's new parameter in the principle. Debated possession is a good possession.
It's something that's dry that loses its sense of smell. It really loses its inherent presence. He said that that's
completely different. He said
the same principle. Because he said that gelatin is
about this new case,
they're dry.
There is a possession.
It's not the fact that it came from
a debatable possession. But what about Talus? How can you tell me that?
Say that.
You want to? I mean, it's Talus, or can you?
Right, that's because we know it came from a pick. You don't know that it came from a pick. That's your question? What ingredients go into ink?
The money is for sure one definite dollar. There's one of us, only one of us gave fruit juice.
They could use pigs for
fake. Yeah, so, but the many money is for sure only one owner.
You know?
So even though this is debatable possession, I'm looking at it. But since the cook falls off to one of us, we can't
have a pen. Is ink made out of pig?
If you're going to tell me the principle is debatable possession is good possession as long as it's able to be true.
It's not my question.
Here's
my
question.
Although I am actually curious to see
what he says. Why would it be an issue?
Some people like to lick their pens before.
It's not really food at that point. It's something to the issue of pastures.
Personally, it's a seed of fruit. For itself,
if you lick your pen and there's some like gelatin or something in the pig, then you're over an isser. I'm saying it's not supposed to doesn't have the same pastures.
There's an idea that it's not there for the
deal. Should be giving out money that's not right
for pills, for pills, for his. Yeah, pills,
maybe it's not
right.
It's always different.
It's
only
right
for the last
door.
None of
that's the same. Why is the port giving out half done?
Caffeine pills.
But Cole, you're not even putting this in your mouth. It's
helpful on the shaman's
object. Can't even be concerned,
why do you think that makes a difference?
A tuple that is
because
very...
Because there's a part that says that if there's something that even a dog wouldn't eat it, it's not considered food. It doesn't have the health of kashrus.
What's that over there, buddy?
No, if it's massage, then that'd be...
That's talking about comments.
Yeah, comments are the most comparable to the actual star.
Tuffle, this is Tuffle on Olympus, but Michael Akram and Nephilim.
Burning the fuck, it has to be so destroyed.
Terugas Akram, Tolkien Akram wrote. Terugas, you go up to the road.
I mean, everybody worries crazy.
We have something which is not
cultural, but don't know what it is. That is me, the initial tree, Tolkien Akram, the fruit juice bubble to itself.
It's a case. They're possible.
Brain pre couple of
I actually have an interesting question. I'm going to ask him. I read an article a few months ago about a hamburger that cost $300,000. Why did it cost so much? Because the meat is grown in a lab.
That's a possible that maybe
the meat is grown in a test tube.
It's hard.
Why?
Actually, depends how it was. It actually depends on just possible. No, that's what I heard around. It depends on how it's made, is actually the answer. If it was made from like one
so cell, if it was charbroiled. Really?
It depends, because there's different ways of making it.
No, I'm saying, like, that's coming for that's the issue. Don't mind that.
Well, that's why I'm going to wait for a Q&A. No offense.
Why they both claiming it's fully there?
$1,000.
It's crazy expensive.
It's like $1,000 maybe for a pound.
Is there a possibility that
part of the cheese if you get all the meat?
Oh, my mother would finally make for delicious
part of the cheese.
Yeah, then run after it. We'll check it out.
Lasagna.
Oh, I missed it. He grabbed on that.
I can't drink milk from it.
So we'll have to
see there's a scenario where he really eats one of the meals half. But he didn't see that.
What if you kill the cow, cook it, and then revive it?
So
the animal's alive again, so it would still be from like a dead animal.
I don't know.
I mean, you could do that theoretically. Well, you could kill it.
Exactly.
Stop its heart and then like quickly milk it while it's
like, so the milk is deflated.
Do CPR or whatever's happened, it comes back to life. Voila.
Cheeseburgers.
Or, you know, just go and read the, like, the mystical Kabbalah books that Abraham would even had and just make a cow out of the name and then it's far.
Yeah, save for your tear.
Yeah.
I have it in my room. Do you want to borrow it?
I'm good.
Okay.
Wait, you can make it.
Yeah.
Those homo focused between Yosef and his brothers, when he reported to his dad that they were eating.
Abram wasn't using, he was the one that wrote it.
Make a cow, and since the cow was made from nothing, it's actually a part of the cow. Yeah, if you have a savory tzira, I would make like a chest of gold.
No idea what he's talking about. It's not helping you practically. And it's basically not making any difference. You're like talking about healing with us.
Yeah, I know that.
I know that 100%.
That's what I look
at. Same thing with the Zohar, same thing with the Tanya.
It will be Muna.
Any highly Kabbalistic word, nobody on our level would be copying
the last
little bit.
Until the Yahweh Hanavi comes. He'll be able to tell us the word.
Yes.
Until the Yahweh Hanavi.
Rabbi Greenblatt,
people can learn Tanya. The Zohar is a different thing. Zohar is a different kind of thing. Nevi Shachayim and Tanya are contemporary books.
Yeah, but they were very highly Kabbalistic.
That's true. But they're learned by the masses.
Maybe correctly. I mean, that was one of the things that the Vilna Gaon did highly screwed with the Synod for trying to spread
this. That's true, but you're also saying that was a time.
Is there Michael who we have like
the opposite of
you just agreed to do right there, just because he was in the woods and not worried. That's why he disagreed with it. He disagrees because he's Rav Nana.
Means it belongs to both of them.
Sorry. I don't know.
So we divide it.
Someone on our level can act up what's going on in the Shekhayim or in the
Tanya.
You
can't figure
out
what the wrong stuff.
Right,
you put it in such a low level.
People.
You don't know what, man.
You're in a debatable position.
Right, so if you're learning the wrong, like we're doing it through
the wrong.
It's different. It's like if you yourself learn it, at our level, I think it's people's minds.
It's a place such a low level.
You just need to be
told. That's the same with the Gemara.
So that'll be, means that.
Well, look, if you don't have to actually, what's going on, like you don't know the Lashon, you just don't have to read the letters.
hey, you should be focusing on how to actually learn Lush so you can actually
the
learn
it.
Any level that's true.
You don't have to read. Every possession is a good possession.
At the end of the day,
as long as it could be true.
Which was the point I was trying to make.
By the 1,000, it could be true. By the 3,000, it cannot be true. Now, but what about this? Is going to leave you with this case.
It's like that machine.
If you want to do it,
what about this
case?
This person's going to bring it. There's two people.
I mean, but look, he needs to make Park Chow's for his future business.
You can even say $1,000.
I don't even know how to do it.
You
guys have already done that for me.
Like a thing that says, I owe you $1,000.
Yeah, that's so expensive.
Now,
what happens if I say
no, I give you a discussion. You give me $1,000. Now you have a document proving that I owe you $1,000. I can take it and make me pay you $1,000. Say, this document, you lend me $1,000. I give you an IOU. I owe you $1,000. I take a document to prove that I borrowed from you $1,000. Now let's say I decide not to pay you. Make me a document and say, I have this note saying that Yakov owes me $1,000. Now what about this problem? The way it works is that let's say I repaid you the money. If I repay you the money, usually you give me this document back.
Under Halacha?
So now you no longer have a proof that I owe you $1,000.
Has anyone else seen that?
I'm sorry, you! Give me this document back and I rip it up. There's no more proof that I owe you.
This is my own.
What happened if I gave it to Hebrew? So two of us dropped the court.
Where'd you buy it?
We're both holding onto this IOU.
This is the shop right next to me. Right next to the building.
You say, hey,
that's a great
where's my $1,000?
It's so much stuff. If he could find
this. Yeah, oh, is that the one that's like all bent over?
And I was trying to steal the document, so yeah, that's why I'm grabbing on.
Like right now we're on
and I'm telling you, I repaid him $1,000, and he gave me back the document, and now he grabbed back on, and he's lying. He's lying.
Levels of court.
So you're telling that I was hitting that line, but the reality is the same. And that's why I was holding on to the document.
It's
if I were to fully have the document, it's a proof I repeat. Otherwise, I'm going to have the document.
No, he doesn't bring in...
Actually, I think the case is more precisely that you are claiming that you lost the document and found it, but I never repeated it. That's why you're grabbing more because you're trying to take it.
Because they pass up, they
maybe
that
they owe you $1,000, so maybe I don't try to pay this to you, and you're
never posted.
So
the sure of me.
Yeah. Apparently, at any point, they could
stop. Yeah, that's because I should one because
the law exists.
Yeah, it's need like 2 seconds.
So, if you don't have that, what do you think should be the problem? Maybe you'll probably be in an hour. So.
I think that's impossible.
Thank you.
In the section on the Ben Gurion, he was desperately trying to get Ben Gurion to not pass this law or anything, and Ben Gurion desperately said to him, I think we're going to have to send him a holiday, and the next week he resigned from all of this.
No, it's like, whoa. You want? Everybody messed up. When you wrote that safer, so he was never on the Robert Goldstein British line, but he was associated with it. Yeah, he was associated with it.
And he said, like, especially after that taper, he verification got a little funny. Because it was like, because it was written like 5 years after, I mean, a few years after the Medina was founded. And so, like, people didn't like that taper was put out because it was like, you know, it was like too soon. And, so his reputation was a little bit tarnished. And so later in his life, he, you know, it got cleaned up, but he said also Robert told me that Robert Yashif, since he was on the Robin his face, and like,
yes,
somewhat his reputation also got a little bit smeared.
At the time, barely anyone knew who he was.
But he said he got a little bit.
Before he went on the base, to like no one knew who he was. Anyone on the base, and then like a few people, and like actually I knew who he was. Like, most people had no idea who he was until like the 80s, maybe the 90s, soon before Shaft was there, like 90s. So only soon before that was the Revolution. Like, become like.
And that's like the 80s, he was like 70s.
Sorry, I might have to be a bit of a shorter session today. So what's up for today?
I've seen in the Gemaras, some of it'll say go after the shuk and see the halacha people are doing, and then we'll determine the halacha that way.
Yeah, and wouldn't work today.
it'd be somewhat problematic today.
Yeah.
What exactly does that mean when it mentions it in the Gemara, and how it would apply?
Well, even then, it didn't mean go to Amaratzim, but there is a musik that Klal Yisrael as a nation is very attuned to the Ratzon Hashem, that the instincts of people who try to keep mitzvot are connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore often Chazal had such faith in the integrity and the holiness of the Jewish neshama that if Yidden gravitated to a certain position, either they did so because Chachamim told them to do so, and they have Amunas Chachamim, or even if there was no Chacham that told them, they're doing what Hashem wants them to do. Now, this only works when you have a door that are in a high level of Kedusha, and a door that lives with Amunas Chachamim. You know, I'll give you an example. We talk about, you know, magnetic fields, right? So a compass will point to true north, or, you know, because of the magnetic field of the earth. But if you have opposite magnetic fields, like other magnets, whatever it is, that throws it totally off. So the natural teva of a Jewish soul is to point to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Ratzon. But when you have a lot of taivas, when you have a decadent society, those are contradictory magnetic fields that throw everything off. So Bizman HaZeh, I would have to say the instinct is not as good. But Chazal were Mashiach, that in their door, the Jewish instinct itself was a proper instinct. That the Neshama is connected to Hashem. And that's why Chazal were willing to, in cases of machlokas, to be kaveya halacha based on what Am Yisrael did.
The question I have is, since in Judaism we believe in reincarnation, is it possible, I mean, I don't know if you can tell, but is there a way to know if someone who's like an Israelite in their body today was a Kohen in another life?
Well, a way to know is very, very difficult. You know, in psychological literature, there is a whole field called past life regression, where under hypnosis, people say they remember what things were like in a previous life, but we're not really sure if that is scientifically accurate. I actually heard from a Gadol once that he thought that there's no way we can actually retrieve the experiences of a Gilgal. Although they bring one of the Hasidic Rebbe's, I think it was the Rezina Rebbe, felt he was a Kohen Gadol in his prior life. So on Yom Kippur, when he was the Baal Tefillah for Musaf, and it says in the Musaf, Kach Haya Omer, this is what he used to say, the Kohen Gadol used to say, Ana Hashem. So he would say as Chazan, Kach Hayisi Omer, just to say. You know, but you know, who knows? So, psychologists actually say, who believe in reincarnation, actually say, yes, you can relive it. What I heard is that it's not something we can access on a conscious level.
What I'm saying is, at Sinai, when the souls were brought down, doesn't that soul stay a Kohen forever? Or, like, different people, like, do we have the same souls that we had at Sinai?
No, it's lav dafka. In other words, let me put it this way. Something can be the same soul, but we wouldn't say a Kohen is a different soul, meaning the soul can be mislabesh, it can be enveloped, it can be dressed in different suros. A man could be a woman could be a man, a Kohen could be a Levi or a Yisrael, and vice versa. You can be upgraded. So your halachic identity, could you be a goy? Probably not. An animal? Well, it's brought down in some svarim that tzaddikim are reincarnated as fish that are eaten on Shabbos. And they say Rishayim are reincarnated as dogs or something like that. You know, I don't know. A lot of this is shrouded in mystery. But certainly the massive can change. You know, if you ever go to Tzfat, so you'll often see animals wandering around. And I remember at one JLE trip, there was a big dog that would come in to every shear and listen to a shear. And he would sit very quietly and then walk away. And, you know, people say, oh, it's not, you know, maybe it's a gilgul of somebody who didn't hear enough Torah in his lifetime, so he has to kind of hear every shear and then go away. You know, who knows? We don't really know. Let me just remind you that Gilgal is not mentioned in the Gemara. So the Medrash or the Gemara do not talk about Gilgal at all. Gilgal is an idea that is developed by the Arizal and the Mekubalim. And then it kind of entered, with one exception, the Ramban. The Ramban mentions Gilgulim. The Ramban interprets Sefer Iyuv, which is the mystery of why a righteous person suffers. The Ramban interprets Sefer Iyuv as based on Gilgul, that you're suffering for prior sins. But as I say, since the Rambam doesn't mention it, and the Gemara doesn't mention it, we can't say that Gilgul is an Ikar Emuna. But certainly the great Mekubalim and the Ramban do believe in Gilgul. Yeah.
What are the parameters of the halacha of not giving gifts to Goyim, and specifically with regards to like giving tzedakah?
Yeah, so there are two different halachas about giving gifts to Goyim. One is a general principle that you don't give a Goy a gift around the holiday time. So you don't give him around December 25th. This was the 3 days of December 25th. Because that may cause him to, the Gemara says it may cause him to go to church and give a Thanksgiving prayer, oh, Baruch Hashem, whatever, not Baruch Hashem, but Baruch, whatever, that you gave me such a nice gift. And then there's a general halacha, which is, many people say it's deoraisa, that you're not allowed to give a matnas chinam, a gift, to an idolater. Now there's a machlokas rishainim, maybe that does not apply to Islam, because they are not idolaters, but it might apply to a Christian, or at least a Catholic, and the like. Now, this din of lo sechanem, not giving a goy or an idol worshiper a gift, the Ran says that only applies if you're not getting any benefit from it. So if, for example, you have a worker, and you give him a gift, not around the holiday, in order that he should be a better worker for you in the future, even though it's a gift, that's mutter because you're doing it for your own particular toelis. The same thing would be true. Let's say you're in an office where everybody gives birthday gifts to everybody. Again, I'm not mentioning Christmas gifts because that would be a particular shaila. So if you wouldn't give a birthday gift, you know, they would look down at you. They would think you're a bad guy. So that would also be mutter because of that particular principle. So we're pretty makil on when we look at what benefit am I getting by giving the person the gift. If you have a non-Jew working for you, you know, you might always give him a gift because it's a way of establishing his loyalty. Now, legabe tztaka to goyim. Tztaka is a different situation. The Mishnah says in Gittin, Beferish, that we do give tztaka even to the aniyim of Ovdei Kechavim, even idol worshippers. And the reason is because of darchei shalom. Now, there's a very fascinating machlekes Rashi in the Rambam, what is Darche Shalom, ways of peace. Rashi learns this way. It goes back to the idea of, well, if you don't take care of the Goyim are going to hate Jews, and if they're going to hate Jews, they're going to kill Jews. So we're really giving it so there should be Shalom for Yidden. So according to Rashi, the heter of giving tzedakah to goyim is that there shouldn't be animosity against Jews. That's Rashi's shita. The Rambam says very differently. The Rambam says the reason we give tzedakah to goyim is because we are emulating the midah of Hashem, where it says in Tehillim in Ashrei, V'rachamav al kol ma'asav, Hashem's mercy is on everyone. And the shalom doesn't just mean shalom for Jews, but we want to bring shalom for non-Jews as well. So to put it in a bit of a fancier way, Rashi seems to learn that the ethical obligations really run to Jews, but goyim will benefit because that way it'll be better for Jews. Rashi does articulate what you might call a universalistic ethic, in which intrinsically our Rachmanis should be on everybody. So many people gravitate to the Rambam's interpretation. I'm not going to be machria, but clearly you are allowed to give tzedakah to goyim. The only thing you have to be careful of is, number one, not to time it with the holidays, the non-Jewish holidays, and number two, be sure you're not giving it to activities that involve avodah zarah, like directly to churches or the like. Now, there's an opposite question. Are you allowed to accept charity from non-Jewish sources? This has been a very big issue. Christian groups have donated a lot of money to the State of Israel and various other educational projects, including some more modern yeshivas and the like. And there the halacha actually is, one should endeavor very strongly not to accept charity from non-Jews, even if they're not idol worshippers, for mostos of Torah and Kedusha. And the source of that is actually in Tanakh. In the book of Ezra, it is recorded that when the Yidden were building the Bayis Sheni, there were people, non-Jews, who lived in the land who wanted to contribute, and Ezra refused to take those contributions. And that's actually brought down by halacha. So in effect, there's actually much more problem accepting tzedakah from goyim than there is to give tzedakah to goyim. Yeah.
Is the Mishkan, is it more b'di'evet, or is it l'chatchila? Like, because if they wouldn't have sinned with the golden calf, they would have gone straight to Eretz Yisrael and would have no need for the Mishkan.
Right. So this is actually, you touched upon an important thing. This is actually a machlokes Rashi and Ramban. Rashi understands, had there not been a chet ha'egel, had there not been a sin of the golden calf, there would have been no need for the Mishkan. In fact, there wouldn't even have been a need for the Beis HaMikdash, because in a sense, all of Eretz Yisrael would be the holy temple of Hashem, and every Jew would be like a Kohen. And it's only because we lost that spiritual closeness that we need a special place and special people. So the Mishkan is actually symbolic of a failure in Am Yisrael. And according to Rashi, even though the Mishkan is recorded, the details of the Mishkan are recorded before the Chet HaEgel, Rashi says, "Ein mukdam u'me'ucher b'Torah," the Torah does not follow chronological order. So Rashi sustains exactly your position. The Ramban, however, seems to indicate that it's not a b'di'evet, really it's part of Hashem's love for us that He gives us a special place where we can connect. So there are two different ways of viewing the Beis HaMikdash. 100% correct. Machlokes Rashi and Ramban. Yeah.
I asked about the number of English speaking Buddhist converts being Jewish and seeking spiritual connection.
I'm sorry, a number, say again, number?
A number of Buddhist, English.
Oh, Buddhist, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, is the neshama susceptible to sheker, or is it other emotions that play?
Well, I think what I was speaking about, to be sure we're talking about the same thing, I was talking about the Jews that gravitate to Buddhism, not the Buddhists that gravitate to Judaism.
English speaking or Buddhist converts.
That's correct. In other words, the statistic that I mentioned occasionally is that 90% of English-speaking converts to Buddhism are Jews. Right? So Jews have a strong attraction to Buddhism. I would say this. The way I connect it is, if you remember, there used to be a tremendously strong Yetzer Hara for idolatry. And at the time of the Bayis Sheni, Ezra was mispalel, and we lost that Yetzer Hara, and it was taken away. Now, when the Gemara describes the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah, taking it away, it describes it as a lion, a fiery lion, that ran out of the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Now that's a pretty bizarre imagery, that the evil Yetzirah of Avodah Zarah, that's the worst of Eivor in the Torah, should be a fiery lion from the Kodesh HaKadoshim, which is the holiest place. But the answer is, the Rambam explains that the origin of Avodah Zarah is not an evil origin. The origin of the Avodah Zarah is a person has such a desire to connect to Hashem. And a person feels the presence of Hashem as so awesome and so magnificent and so powerful that he feels he's not worthy to talk to Hashem. So he wants to relate by the subordinates. Just like you wouldn't go to the president, you know, to get your college transcript straightened out. You go to the lower people. So Avodah Zarah started off out of a tremendous Yiras Hashem. Yiras Haromimus, that means a sense of Hashem's awe. So the Gra says, when they took away the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah, it's like a spiritual lobotomy. In other words, they don't do that much today, but that used to be a procedure. If you had seizures or whatever it is, they would literally cut away some of your brain. Now, there's good things and bad things. The good things is you don't have the seizures. The bad thing is you lose some of your emotional depth. A person with a lobotomy tends to have what you call a flatter personality. They don't feel that strongly anymore. Which means losing the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah was actually a tragedy in a sense, but it was a necessary tragedy. It was a tragedy because our tremendous Yiras Hashem led us to Sheker and led us to false leads and led us to intermediaries. So it was taken away, but that does have diminished feelings of Ruchnias. In other words, how many of us feel, oh, I can't daven because how can I dare come to Hashem? If we don't want to daven, it's because of laziness, we want to sleep late. It's not that I'm coming to the Beis Medrash and I'm shaking and I can't do it. You see what I'm saying? So I think that Buddhists actually have, they kind of escaped the cycle. They have the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah. They have a great, great feeling for Kedusha, a great feeling for Ruchnius. But it gets distorted. This is exactly why. It's almost as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to understand why the Yetzer Hara of idolatry was taken away, because it could lead to going off the derech. But that does mean, in their spiritual personalities, there's a great, great potential for Kedusha, which might be greater than most of us who don't have those particular feelings. See what I'm saying? So it's a very subtle thing, that sometimes feelings whose intensity can be very, very holy might be too much for me to handle, and it could lead me into wrong things. And that's why most of us have lobotomies, and some people don't have the lobotomies, but the people who don't have the lobotomies become Buddhists. So in a sense, HaKadosh Baruch Hu decided it's better for most of us to be a bit diminished in that. Okay, so that's how I might understand it a little bit. Yeah.
Are we supposed to have Avos Yisrael for certain Jews that are trying to destroy the Torah world?
That's a loaded question, the way you put it. I would actually say yes. I would say yes, in the sense that even though it is true that the Russia Marusha, there is no Chiyuv, and in fact it might even be Usher to have Avos Yisrael to a Russia Gomer. But the MS is, even people that are trying to destroy the Torah world may not qualify as a Russia Gomer. You know, they didn't have the background, they didn't have the education, they didn't have the Chinuch. And as a result, they're doing bad things, but it's not because they want to rebel against Hashem. So I think Bizman Hazeh, I'm not saying it's impossible, but Bizman Hazeh, a true category of Russia, is going to be hard to find. And Avos Yisrael is a wonderful thing, because Shlomo HaMelech says in Mishlei, Shlomo HaMelech was the Chacham Mikol Adam, Kamayim aponim aponim, as water reflects the face you show the water, so the heart of man reflects the heart that you show it. Now what does that mean? When I smile at water in a reflection, I get back a smile. When I frown, I get back a frown. So too, the heart of one person reflects what the other heart shows him. I show a person love, he will love me. I show a person hate, me. And in the ongoing struggles that we have with the secular community and about the army and all sorts of issues here, you know, if we would have a greater Avos Yisrael, they would have a greater Avos Yisrael. So I don't think that the derech of success in this endeavor is by creating animosity and sinna. Maybe even if you're not going to call it sinas chinam, just call it sinna, because maybe it's not chinam. I think we will create hatzlacha only by ava, but of course you have to be careful, because loving people doesn't mean compromising. So that's the danger. Sometimes the ava Yisrael is taken as compromise, and you know, I'm okay, you're okay, and sure, the gay march is fine, and okay, you know. It's a very difficult talent to kind of be firm in the MS, but at the same time connect to people with ava. And there were, you know, we've always had gedolim who were able to do this. I'll start off with a very early gadol, Avram Avinu. Right? Avram Avinu is called Avraham the Ivri, Avram the Hebrew. Now, why is he called the Ivri? So Chazal, the Ivri leans on one side of the river, because he was able to be on one side of the fence, teaching Emunah and Hashem, even if the whole world thought he was crazy. Avram was stark, committed, almost fanatical. He would not yield on what is the emes. And yet that same Avram prayed for Saddam. He argued with HaKadosh Baruch Hu to save Saddam, and he didn't even argue about his own son Yitzchak. And Avram was known as the Baal Chesed, which means that doesn't have to be a stira. In our world, the personalities tend to be contradictory. If you're the lover of people, you tend to be soft and you don't stand for anything. And then when you're a kanoa, you tend to be mavakal, everybody is an apikoros. But the meat of Avraham Avinu is kind of to do both things at the same time. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was such a gadol, Rav Moshe Feinstein was such a gadol, Yaakov Kamenetsky. For various reasons, the tendency in recent doros, not doros, in recent maybe decades, has been that people are drawing the lines much, much, much more stark and firm. But I think Avos Yisrael could only be a ticket. Okay, so I would very much hope we could live that way.
Yeah. If a woman who's pregnant converts, is the child Jewish or not?
Yeah, so this is okay. So there's a machlokes rishayim. We paskin the child is Jewish, and the child becomes Jewish when the woman goes to the mikveh. Her immersion in the mikveh is also an immersion. Now, you might ask a lumbishic question, and that is, well, wait a second here. In order for a male to be converted, you need two things. You need both immersion and bris. So if the woman has a girl, so we could say the girl only needed mikveh, so the mother's mikveh also counted as a dunk for the girl. But if it's a boy, even if you say the mother's immersion counts as the boy's immersion, but until the boy has a bris, right? But even then, the poskim say that even if the child is a boy, until he's born, he doesn't have the status of a boy. So as a result, he's just an it. And as an it, the immersion of the mother, unisex, the immersion of the mother will help. So lahalacha l'maisa, the child is not a Jew by conversion. The child is a Jew by birth, because... Well, actually, it's a little complicated. There are two different, in other words, the child doesn't need a conversion, but there are two different lumbuses how to describe it. It's a little complicated. One way of describing it is, since the mother was Jewish at the time of his birth, he was born from a Jewish mother. The other way of describing it is, the conversion of the mother is also a conversion of the baby. See, in lumbus, these are two different ways of describing it. Do I say the child underwent a conversion, i.e. through the mother? Or do I say the child doesn't need a conversion because he's born from a woman who is already Jewish? So there's a machlokas how to describe the phenomenon, but the bottom line is the child does not need a further conversion. Yeah.
So that brings a secondary question of, you know, God forbid the father was a Kohen or a Levite. Would the child then be a Kohen or a Levite?
So this, well, okay, let me put it this way. For sure that's not the case, because the Kohen had intercourse with a non-Jewish woman. Mm-hmm. So no matter how you look at it, a child from a relationship where the Kohen was with a non-Jewish woman certainly will not be a Kohen. He'll either be a Yisrael by birth or a Yisrael by conversion, but he will not be a Kohen or a Levite. Yeah.
Often that is, we read through Purushim by Achronim and Rishonim, they're very difficult to understand. So when they were written in their time, were they written for other Talmidei Chachamim? Were they written for the common man? Who exactly was the audience?
Yes, so you know, obviously it depends on what sefer you're talking about, but when you look at the commentaries of Gemara, let's say, the Rashba, the Ritva, the Ramban, they were not written for absolutely common people. They were written for Talmidei Chachamim, and indeed that's why they're still hard for us to... On the other hand, it is also true that there has been a Yeridas Hadoros, which means to say certain Svarim, which may have been clear even to an average Talmud Chacham hundreds of years ago, might not be clear to us. So on one hand, I don't think they were ever written for the common person, but they may have been written for the average Talmud Chacham, in which today the average Talmud Chacham is much inferior and would still have difficulty to understanding them. This is why the Achronim often say that the Rishonim wrote Bekitzer. The Rishonim wrote in a very abbreviated manner, because in their generation, people could get the whole message from the brief treatment. Achronim write much longer, and that actually, you know, you might think that's harder, but actually it's easier because they, although, you know, they get impatient, but the reason why later generations are marich is because when it's niskatnu hadoros, we need more explanation for things because we don't fully understand it. Okay, yeah.
Many people at the end, when they take three steps forward at the end of the Shemona Esrei, they bounce on that.
They bounce on.
So where does that come from? Because I don't know of any.
You know, I'm going to have to check this because I also don't know of any source. And the things that I've seen say there is no source. I mean, the problem is something must have a source because some guy didn't just make it up one day. But I'm not aware of the source. The only source for raising your feet is Kedusha. Kedusha does have a makar of raising your, you know, standing on your toes when you say Kadosh, 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 and even Baruch Kavod Hashem Mimkomo, and that's based on the idea that Kedusha is the praise that the angels give to God. In fact, Kedusha is we are sanctifying Hashem the way the angels sanctify Hashem, and the angels, that's why our legs are together, because angels only have one leg, they don't have like two legs, so we keep our legs together. And in order to kind of raise ourselves to Shemayim, so we get up on our toes. But why at the end of davening I can't think of it other than perhaps the idea, but I'm going to try to check on this, is that even when we finish our davening, we want to remind ourselves we should still be connected to Hashem and Shemayim. We shouldn't just feel, oh, I was with Hashem then and now forget it. But it's a way of saying, after my prayer, may I still be lifted up, but that's only a guess. I'm going to try to check for the makar. Yeah.
How should one divide their time between chazara and learning new things?
You know, it's an excellent question and it's a hard question. One thing that I have to say, which is obvious, it's obviously not my chiddush. Chazal say it hundreds of times, and Gedolim repeat it hundreds and thousands of times, is how important chazara is. And the moment that is often quoted is one who learns without chazara is like one who plants seed and doesn't harvest it. Meaning you put in all the work, but you don't get anything out of it. You don't harvest it. So chazara is extremely, extremely important. Otherwise, you know, what's the use of everything that that you're doing? You know, I would say, listen, I would say that... I would allocate, again, I'm picking a number, I would say it's a good idea that between 25 to 30% of your time should be chazar. So I would do a 70 or 75 new and 25, 30 chazar. And then you figure out how to chazar, but it's very, very important. And it's very, very kedai. It's very, very kedai. To learn, I'll say, 100, let's apply my formula. If I could learn 200 blot a year, so if my choice is 200 blot without chazara or 150 with chazara, there's no question that the 150 with chazara is a much more significant accomplishment. So even if it means you're not learning as much, it's still very, very kedai. Yeah.
When we put on tefillin, we say two brachas, and then after the second one, we say
Baruch Shem.
Baruch Shem.
Yeah.
So why do we say Baruch Shem? Does that imply that we shouldn't be making the second bracha? And if we shouldn't be making it, then why do we make it?
No, as a matter of fact, for sure, it's a very, very big machlokas rishayim, and that's why you say Baruch Shem out of a suffix. The Mechaber, the Rambam Shita, actually is, there is only one bracha on tefillin. I make a bracha lahaniach tefillin, and that covers the yad and the rosh, and there's only one bracha. But if I was mafsik, that which the Gemara says you make the bracha of al mitzvahs is only if you are mafsik between the yad and the rosh. So the bracha of lahaniach can no longer go, but you're not allowed to be mafsik. So then I make an al mitzvahs. So according to the Rambam, you only make a bracha of al mitzvahs when you were mafsik between the brachas, and otherwise you only make lahaniach. Rabbeinu Tam says this way. Chazal were misakin two brachas. Lahaniach goes on the whole mitzvah of tefillin, and then they were misakin al mitzvahs on the tefillin of the rosh. And if you're mafsik, by the way, which you're not supposed to do, you actually make two brachas, lahaniach again and al mitzvah. So, if I'm not mafsik, and I make al mitzvahs because of Rabbeinu Tam, according to the Rambam, it is a bracha levatalah. So since al mitzvahs is a bracha levatalah, according to the, so the chaymer, although the halacha for Ashkenazim is like Rabbeinu Tam, but because of the chumrah of reciting a blessing in vain, we want to negate it by saying Baruch Shem. If you know the general rule that if you say a bracha levatalah, so one of the ways you get a kapara for it is to turn it into a praise where you say Baruch Shem. And we do that because of the machlokes, the Rambam, and Rabbeinu Tam.
Why don't we just say the second bracha?
Because the halacha is like Rabbeinu Tam, meaning we have a hachra what the halacha is like, but to give deference to a possibility of a bracha levatala, you know, in other words, it's not enough of a suffix to say suffix brachas don't make it. But if you could be yitzei all the day, so to speak, say it and then be misakin with Baruch Shem, so it's kedai to do that. It's a chumrah that's brought down. Oh, yeah.
In colloquial speech, sometimes people say like, I'll never do that, or like, I swear, I promise, or anything like that. Just want to be careful when speaking colloquially, not to throw around words like that.
One should be mishtadal very much. In fact, the need to say b'li neder is actually superfluous, because if you didn't use a lashon neder, it doesn't become a neder. So you don't have to say b'li neder, although it's a good idea anyway. But once you use lashonus of I promise, and certainly I swear, which a person should never say in a sentence that way, you are running the very, very chamor possibility of making a neder or a shvua. And you know, you can go to a beis din, you can go to three people and get hataras nedarim. You know, you could do that. But one should be very, very careful. One should be careful not to use words that connote that idea of commitment. So as I say, that's why the minhag became, in case I said such a word, I used b'li neder. But technically, if you didn't use a lashon of neder, you don't have to say b'li neder, but it's a good habit to say b'li neder.
Would it be like promise, guarantee? Like what would be the degree of words?
Well, swear for sure is a problem. Promise is approaching it, meaning promise would at least be a suffix, whether it's a lashon of shavua. So even if you say something, I promise, although it's a contradiction, you're saying, I promise b'li neder. You could say it that way, although that's a little contradiction in a sense. But you should always emphasize that, you know, you're promising to try. Even then, you have to be careful that you're actually going to try, right? You know, as you could say, I don't know, I promise that I'll try, or because it's better not even to use the word promise, but I intend, I will try, I will make efforts, you know, etc.
And there's also like I'll never. That's to stay away from.
Take away from what?
Should one stay away from like saying I'll never do that? Like
yes, yeah, same thing. So with negatives and positives are the same thing, right?
There was an article posted recently about a hamburger that the meat was grown in a lab.
Yeah.
So what would be the status of that meat? Would it be fleshig? Would you have to worry about what the animal it was derived from?
Yes. So here's the thing. This is not purely artificial meat. This is not yesh meayin, or this is not even meat created from chemicals, which would just be chemical meat. Mm-hmm. This is meat created from stem cells, the actual cells of a cow. So as a general rule, we would treat that which is created from the stem cells as being fleshic. But that creates a tremendous problem, because if it was fleshic, it wasn't shechted. So it depends. If you could somehow retrieve the cells from a shechted cow, they could survive a little bit after slaughter, then you would simply have a kosher hamburger you can eat. But there is a real shaila, stem cell, that if you took it from a live animal, and then you culture it in the lab, since it is from a live animal, it might have the status of Iver Menachai, which is very chamer, and at a minimum, it might have the status of Nevela, meaning it wasn't shechted. So you would have a problem, I think. So Bekitzer, it really depends on whether the stem cells were retrieved from a live animal or not. And if they were retrieved from a non-kosher animal, it would seem to be non-kosher meat, like a pig or whatever. Yeah.
With the issue of celebrating non-Jewish holidays,
yes.
Say you're married to a woman who is a Baal Shuva, and growing up she's always had Valentine's Day as a big thing. You know, it's really important to her that you take her out to dinner and buy her a bracelet. Which is it? Is Shalom bias, or is the not celebrating a non-Jewish holiday the overriding factor?
Yeah, well, you know, obviously, I think you yourself would admit there would have to be limits. I mean, let's say she's a Gioris, and you know, Christmas dinner was always a tremendously yeah. important day. You would understand, you know, we can't have a holiday celebrating Yashka's birthday or Easter or whatever it would be. Now, when you get to things like Valentine's Day, you know, it is a bit more tricky, because even though it's technically Saint Valentine's Day, etc., but it's, you know, there's something that may have started off as being connected to a religion at some point is so far removed that it turns into a secular as opposed to a Christian holiday. Thanksgiving might be an example of that as well. So in such a situation, there is a makom to be made that when people do not connect it to religion anymore, it just becomes a seki, and if it's something important to your wife, you know, you could do it. But the best thing to do is do it erev Valentine's, meaning, you know, why do you have to follow the calendar? In other words, the day before Valentine's, 2 days before Valentine's Day, you know, we're going to go out to dinner, because, you know, she doesn't care about Valentine's Day. She cares about you're showing, you know, that you care about her. And you say, listen, it's not a Jewish day, but we'll make the day before a Jewish day, you know. So that's what I would recommend you do.
I've heard a bit about Rav Chaim Brisker's revolutionary method in learning Gemara.
Yeah.
So what was the method, and why is it so revolutionary?
You know, the truth of the matter is it's hard really to put our finger on it. It was a revolutionary method, and all of the advanced learning in yeshivas is based on Rav Chaim's derech. But I have to say it got kind of mixed in with other things, so it's no longer unique. You look at Rav Chaim, you know, it's like an old joke they say about blintzes, where a man was at a rich person's house, and he had the most delicious blintzes, and he told his wife, you make it with oil and eggs and butter. And what happened was, you know, she didn't have the eggs, so she put something else in, she didn't have the butter, whatever. And it turned out that there was nothing special about it, because she followed the recipe exactly except for all the ingredients. So Lamaisa, our learning today, you know, which is really based on Reb Chaim's derech, what's so unique about it? Because the truth is, we don't really do the whole derech. But it's hard for me to tell you exactly what the chiddush is. In other words, it was essentially a very deeply analytical derech of trying to understand a svara, and not simply, in other words, sometimes the Gemara connects, you know, because of X we say B. But Rav Chaim would say, but what is the connection between X and B? Is it just superficial because it's the same words, like, you know? And he would probe behind words and look at underlying concepts. So it's called the conceptual derech. It was not based on verbal similarities. And Rav Chaim was able to do two things. He was able to show how different concepts that have different words are actually the same. And he was able to show how things that have the same words are different. And, you know, now, did he totally invent something? Of course not. Any derech in Torah that's a total invention is wrong. You know, Rishonim do this. Certain Achronim were known for this type of mahalach, the Ketzos, the Nesivis, Rebbe Kiva Eger. But Rav Chaim developed it to a greater and greater degree. and that became the derech of the yeshiva. They say it was hashgacha pratis because Rav Chaim was a Rosh Yeshiva in Volozhin at a time when Jews were beginning to go to university. They were exposed to secular wisdom. And there was a fear that the great intellectual minds would be a travestication of sciences and philosophy unless we showed them that in Torah there was even a greater depth. And therefore Rav Chaim was considered to be minas shamayim, showing the immense depth in Torah that was not always perceived in less deep ways of learning. So that was the Rav Chaim derech. Now, that does mean there were certain things Rav Chaim's derech did not pay that much attention to. Rav Chaim's derech did not pay that much attention to the lashon of the Gemara. There was often more interest in the conceptual structure and in the svara. That's why you find today that there's hybrid derechim that focus on the shakla v'tarya, the pshat, the havamina. Rav Chaim's derech did not talk about a lot of those things. He didn't talk about the havaminas. It was essentially analyzing maskanas. Rav Chaim's derech was not so interested in being medayek in lashonis. Right? So if you notice, our shiurim are not pure brisker shiurim. Our shiurim involve analyzing havaminas, analyzing the mahalich of a shakla v'tarya, and analyzing the lashon of rishonim. Rav Chaim, of course, did all this. Rav Chaim was a gain in all shtachim, but Rav Chaim's shiurim tended not to emphasize those points. So that's why I'm saying our Jeruchim are more of a hybrid. That's why the Chazon Ish, didn't like Rav Chaim's derech. You know, for that reason, he felt Rav Chaim's derech was not connected closely enough to the actual Shatra Vitaria of a Gemara. Yeah.
What defines someone as a Mekubal, and what how do you tell the difference between like the real thing, and there's been all the stories in the news lately of...
Yeah, one rule of thumb is anyone that says he's a Mekubal probably isn't. That's the, those who are don't say, and those who say aren't. You know, that's kind of, that's not totally true, but often that's the case. It is very, very difficult. Rav Yaakov Hillel, who indeed is a Mekubal, although I like to call him the non-Mekubal Mekubal because, people come to him for amulets and everything else, and if they come for exorcisms, and he says, go to a psychiatrist, but he says, and again, it's not just he, but that a person can be an authentic Mekubal only if he is also a big Talmud Chacham and a Gaon in the revealed part of the Torah, because that's our foundation. A person who has a foundation in Shas and Poskim and then has built on that foundation to the deeper, more esoteric parts of the Torah. So his palace, so to speak, his sulam that is going up to Shemayim, has a firm foundation. So number one, if the person is not a Talmud Chacham, he doesn't have to be the Gadol, if it's not a big, big Talmud Chacham in Shas and Poskim, then you have to mistrust his Kabbalistic knowledge. Second of all, he has to be a Shomer Mitzvah, which is very important. Now, you may think that's obvious, but when they had the Kabbalah Center of America, etc., which is a big thing, Madonna, all the Hollywood people, go to this thing. But the people who run it were not Shomer Mitzvahs. If a person is not Shomer Mitzvahs, how could he be Zocha to penetrate the Panemius of the Torah? So the person has to be a Talmud Chacham, the person has to be a Shomer Mitzvahs, and the person has to be a person who is not in it for the money, meaning... If every time you give to a bracha, there's a charge, etc., then the kavanas are not totally l'shem shemayim. So are we able to always judge all of these? Not necessarily. So that's why you need to go to your Rebbe, to your Rosh Hashiva, and for a determination. You may need some Das Torah to be able to be machriya on this. But it is a difficult issue, especially in Eretz Yisrael today, where Kabbalah is so popular, so to speak. So there are real Mekubalim, Baruch Hashem, there are real Mekubalim, but there are a lot of fakers as well. And one has to know. If the only thing a faker would do would be it'd be worthless, that wouldn't be so bad. I wasted my time with a faker. The problem is that when you have people that use the ideas of Kabbalah and they're not really true Mekubalim, it's not just it's a waste of time. It could be mazik your neshama. It could hurt you. You could walk away worse than you were beforehand So it's important not to get involved in those inyanim. Yeah, I'm sorry, I have to break, but okay, much love.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Something that swallows up the desires.
Your water machine.
He's just saying that there's not going to be any good time. I don't know how exactly the place will be. I think because an oila is supposed to be, an oila has to be shattered, right? It has to be organ oil, so you can't eat that.
But there are oil and oil in the also, which look funny, but it point of view. It's a nana and a
It seems like something, it seems like something that you could eat, something that the kohanim can eat, that's considered like it could be eaten. Therefore, it's not like it's stealing from the person. It's not like it's
just taking it.
It's really supposed to be eaten. It's not really for the person.
Good idea.
But an oiler, right? An oiler has to be all accepted.
Because I'm not moving very well, but hook the shot. Eyelash aimed by Hector the Crane. Since it was Mactis for Eyelash, it's not the
Hector
the Crane. Nothing can eat it.
A royal shot
is made like a hatter. And I was used to meet him either. There's nothing to take out of me either. To be sure, I'm there. I am like Eden, but he says you're not for me anymore. She told me to show her the Shina Shima on my Seha Mukaimai. You change everything about it. You change the Shima, you change my Seha, you change its actions, and you change its place. Now it's like a Khatas. It becomes like a Khatas. It becomes like a Khatas that was. Seems like this is the cloud. When a Kohanim can eat it, then there's no Me'ila. When the Kohanim can eat it, there's no Me'ila. Don't feel bad.
Right.
So with the Chattas, if you do it completely right, they can eat it. So therefore, but an Oila could never work, right? Because they can never eat it. And a chattis that you mess up, is another option. But an oil you can never eat, they can eat this. Depending on whether they did it right or they did it wrong, then you could eat it or not. If they did it wrong, they couldn't eat it. And if you did it right, they could eat it. And if they could eat it, there's no meila. Maybe Yeshua says that this oil that was really started off being oil, but then you do everything else for like a chattis, it becomes like a chattis, and therefore there's no me'ila, because now you can eat it. So it basically becomes like a chattis. He says, V'hoyos v'shino shma, maseo v'koyma. You changed what was the shma, and it's actually changed the place. I'm over here, right of the dabar. Holiday limo, kava koyma. And Rabbi Nezer is going to come and say, no, this still is more evil than we were. Well, just like it, you can see that from a Chattas, there wasn't done the Shema. Chattas, if she also had coined the Shema, Macha, she would have done the Shema, and by a Chattas that isn't done this more. It should be possible, right? Should it not be possible? Just another word, not a shame, but even more. Chattis, right? If it's another word, it's possible. If he does do this more, there is no more ill, there's no more ill in bar, since they can eat it. Kishishina is Shema, my Eden Bar. This is actually in the Likha, it's very small, the same Oila. If you did the Likha, the same Oila, okay, which Nisla, so it says, I call him my Eden Bar.